better for that.
And now, from a perch high atop the impressive newsroom at one of America's great newspapers.
Does that mean what I think it means?
It's Andy Parks, live from the Washington Times.
Well, hello. Welcome to the program. It is Tuesday. I just checked, and sure enough, it is. Great to have you along. Welcome to the program, 306, 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. Andy Parks live from the Washington Times. Hour number one officially underway with this. The spinning of the wheel. Yes, very important today. Ann Wogue is now stepping over to the wheel, but please don't spin yet because I want to check some of the little post-it notes on the wheel. Let's see. Smoking gun White House email. Oh, I like that. Stock market's gone crazy. New Dow record. DHS says 5,000 more illegals will be set free due to sequestration. And by the way, did you see where yesterday the government posted 400 new jobs? I thought we were out of money. Oh, maybe not. TSA will allow knives on planes. Well, that's good news. Snow in Chicago. It's winter. Snow is supposed to happen in Chicago. Oh, let's see what else is up there. Missouri bank employee shoots a robber. That's good. And, higher taxes in Maryland. Wow, where do we begin? Well, Ann Wogue, spin the wheel. Wow. Oh, how about that? We're going to start with the snow. Oh, believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen, it is snowing in Chicago, and you are not going to believe it. Let's eavesdrop on CNN, shall we?
You should get warm. I can't believe how happy you look to be out there in the snow.
It's going to get worse.
It is definitely going to get worse. We'll be following
I'm very happy.
Jennifer Delgado for us in Chicago. Thank you. Stay warm. Now, tonight, Piers Morgan will ask the question, is global warming causing more of these massive storms? That's tonight at 9 Eastern right here on CNN.
In America, you have a right to be stupid.
Mm-hmm. You're an unbelievably stupid man, aren't you?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, that is the liberal left at work. It is snowing in Chicago in the wintertime. It has got to be global warming. Are you kidding? Are you kidding me? Piers Morgan tonight on CNN. We'll talk about global warming as it relates to a winter storm in Chicago. Hey, I've been on this planet for a while. It snows every winter in Chicago. They get lots of snow there. They get lots of these storms. Somehow, all of a sudden, it's global warming. Man, normally I'm not laughing this early in the show, but I'm sorry. You know? Honestly, the left has gone just teetotally nuts in this country. They're gone. They're absolutely over the top gone. And yet they're in power. Man, oh man. All right, let's see what else we can wander into. As you know, America is waiting for the total collapse of our economy under sequestration. So far, that hasn't happened, much to the chagrin of the president. Well, yeah. Seriously. I mean, he wants America to suffer so he can blame the Republicans. We've talked about this for days. He wants to be able to blame the Republicans, right? They're the bad guys. They want to take over the House in 2014, they being the Democrats. Well, there may be something to this. Stephen Dinan, Washington Times political editor, has just posted a story online at WashingtonTimes.com, and it's already on Drudge Report. The Obama administration denied an appeal for flexibility in lessening the sequester effects with an email this week appearing to show officials in Washington that because they already had promised cuts would be devastating, they now have to follow through on that. The email was sent yesterday by Charles Brown, an official with the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service office in Raleigh, North Carolina. Mr. Brown asked if there was any latitude in how to spread the sequester cuts across the region to lessen the impacts on fish inspections. He said he was discouraged by officials in Washington who gave him this reply, quote, "We have gone on record with a notification to Congress and whoever else that APHIS would eliminate assistance to producers in 24 states in managing wildlife damage to the aquaculture industry unless they provide funding to cover the cost. So it is our opinion that however you manage that reduction, you need to make sure you are not contradicting what we said the impact would be." This email, of course, confirms what many Americans have suspected. The Obama administration is doing everything they can to make sure their worst predictions come true and to maximize the pain of the sequester cuts for political gain. That, according to Tim Griffin, congressman from Arkansas. Yes, and a Republican. Anyway, more on that coming up in a little while. Stephen will be along in the 4 o'clock hour. Got lots to talk to him about today. Oh, and of course the big news today relating to the sequester, the White House made the announcement it was canceling all public tours because of the sequester spending cuts. Seriously? Really? Okay. I got to tell you, this guy's really playing the game, isn't he? I have never in my life seen a president do what this man is doing. Never. Never. It's an embarrassment. Ugh. Yep, he wants America to hurt. We've got proof now in the email. They want America to hurt. We said it was going to be bad. Now it better be bad. And remember yesterday I played the left-wing stuff from Chris Matthews and from Dan Rather. Oh, well, you know, this is not good for his image. If things don't go bad, then it's bad for his image. And, of course, that's all they worry about is the president's image. Britt Hume explained a lot of what's going on Bill O'Reilly's show last night on Fox.
The president seems prepared to let the public suffer almost as much as possible as long as he can blame somebody else. This is not what we expect of presidents.
That's
presidents,
right,
in the end, are supposed to be the people who put on their big boy pants and are prepared to shoulder responsibility. And if they're criticized for using that responsibility or authority, so be it. But that's what you expect of presidents. This president seems more inclined to let the chips fall where they may and hit as hard as they might, as long as he thinks he can blame somebody else. It's very unusual for a president.
Yes, it is. It's very unusual. Put on your big boy pants. Of course it's unusual for a president. But it's not about country, remember, Britt? It's about Democrats, and it's about Barack Obama.
He thinks that politically, if this comes down hard, these spending cuts, or cuts in the growth of spending on people, and they feel it at the airport or wherever else it might be, and they'll blame the Republicans, that perhaps he can then turn the tables and regain the House of Representatives for his party in 2014, and then he can do whatever he wants for the final 2 years in office. The problem is that this is a classic example of what James Reston, talking about Lyndon Johnson, once described as dealing with the politics of your problem and not the problem itself.
Yeah, exactly. The problem is we spend too much. We have too much debt. He doesn't see it. He, like other Democrats, are like the ostrich with the head in the sand. His followers are right there with him. I don't know if you caught it, but James Carville was with Sean Hannity last night. He actually claimed the debt is going down.
It's actually starting to go down. We can't have a long-run problem, but, you know, the health care cost numbers are looking good.
What?
Right now, if we just we have to try to keep to the extent that we have a recovery, keep it going.
The debt is going down? No, it's not. It's going up every second of the day. Obama tells us he's already cut $2.5 trillion from the debt. So why is the national debt clock just now zipping past 16.6? 16.6 trillion. And not, if he cut $2.5 trillion from it, why doesn't it read 14.1 trillion? Because he really hasn't cut the debt. He wants America to believe that, but he's done nothing of the sort. And did you know that last month alone we borrowed six times that $85 billion sequester number? Six times! What we're asking for in cuts was borrowed last month alone. It's true. It's true. And Carbo says, oh yeah, and by the way, that Obamacare, the health care numbers, oh, they're looking good. They are? Every indication from any medical provider is we will pay more. So the numbers are looking good? Man. Oh, I don't even, you know what, I got to get into some of this Janet Napolitano craziness. We'll do that when I come back in just a couple of minutes. Guns are still in the news. We've got Maryland Governor Martin Omani coming up with another $3.4 billion of Maryland tax money. That's right. He's reaching back in your pocket again. And let's see what else is going on. No, I just, you know, the pile is so high, I can't get to the bottom of it right now. So you'll have to stay tuned, and that's an order. 317, 730 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. It's Andy Parks, live from the Washington Time. Welcome back. 319, 730 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. Andy Parks, live from the Washington Times. Nice to have you along. All right, so here we are. I guess it's officially day two. I mean, I guess technically it'd be day four if the effects of sequester occurred over the weekend. You know, midnight Friday night is what they decided on as the start for it. But, I mean, look, this second work day. So what we're doing is we're looking at the effects today of sequestration. And so far, so good. Despite the fact that I just mentioned the White House will be closing down White House tours as a result of running out of money, I guess. You know, why would that have to happen? Seriously. You know, couldn't we have volunteers conduct the tour at the White House? Couldn't we have the Obama family do that? Hi, we're the Obamas. Come on in. Welcome to our home. Anyway. So here we are, so far so good. Despite Janet Napolitano's comments from yesterday saying there were longer than normal lines, did you see this story? She said that there were 150 to 200% longer lines at security at LAX and O'Hare, something that proved to be untrue. In fact, FAA officials at both airports said, we don't know what she's talking about. We were kind of in the normal operation mode yesterday. Everything was fine, and people had very little problem in getting through security, and flight delays were virtually non-existent. So where she got that? Who knows? She also addressed the release of illegals at a Politico-sponsored event yesterday. Check this out.
Tana, there's been a lot of publicity recently about some releases of immigrant detainees. You were explaining to me that there's a numerical issue you face. Explain that.
Well, there's a story that ran last week. It says, we released 2,000 detainees because of sequester. Mm-hmm. That is really not accurate.
And was not a Politico story, by the way.
No, it was a Washington Times story, if I recall.
And I won't say who put it out there.
Oh, well, you don't have to. I just did.
As in all things immigration, it develops its own mythology.
Mythology!
Here's the deal. We are constantly, as the secretaries know, moving people in and out of detention. These are immigrants who, illegal immigrants, who for one reason or another are judged better in detention than under some alternative. With sequester looming and the end of this continuing resolution in a couple of weeks, it's like the perfect storm. We really have to manage so many different things because we don't have a budget. The normal ebb and flow accounted for many of those releases. And these are people who are removed or they were bonded out or their status was changed for whatever reason. I think, however, for sequester, getting ahead of that looming deadline, career officials made the decision that there were some very, what I would call, very low-level, low-risk detainees that could be put into a supervised release program, and that's what happened. Yeah. And we're going to continue to do that, recognizing the secretaries will really understand the rock and a hard place analogy. On the one hand, Congress says you have to maintain 34,000 beds. And on the other hand, they say, and we're not going to give you really the money with which to do that. Mm-hmm. And they don't also give you any flexibility to move money, say, from another account with which to handle that. So we are going to manage our way through this by identifying the lowest risk detainees and putting them into some kind of alternative to release.
But this is related to sequester or it's not?
Several hundred are related to sequester, but it wasn't thousands.
And it's going to continue?
For the foreseeable future, yes.
Yes, it is going to continue. In fact, we got word a little while ago it's going to continue to the tune of 5,000 more releases as a result of sequester. That came from Janet Napolitano, surprisingly, today. Mm-hmm. Now, you may recall last week she said that none of the releases were sequester-related. Funny, in that soundbite we just heard at the end, she did say that, oh, hundreds were sequester-related. Funny how she changed her story, isn't it? And don't you love her talk of mythology when it comes to the Washington Times story that outed her last week? She says the story of the release develops a mythology. Okay, let me ask you this. Were they released? Yes. Did they have criminal backgrounds? Yes. Were some of those releases related to sequester? Yes. That's mythology? Really? How about fact? And don't you love the way she says it? You know, and some of the lesser of the criminal element, they were released, and they'll be under supervision. Really? Did you happen to see the one guy who was released last week being interviewed on the way out the door? This guy's released from this deportation holding tank, and he's excited because he thinks Axon made a mistake, and now he can disappear forever. What do you think the odds of this guy, what are the odds of this guy showing up for his probation hearing every week? Seriously. He's on a list to be deported. Do you think he's going to come next Tuesday? He's going to show up and say, hey, I'm still hanging out here waiting to be deported. I mean, think about that. Really? You really think the guy's going to do that? These are the people running our country. Janet Napolitano, in charge of Homeland Security? Really? And we don't have the money? We don't have the budget? But you certainly had the budget to okay a new $50 million deal the night before sequestration hit, didn't you, Madam Secretary? Did you or did you not sign off on an agreement to buy $50 million in new uniforms for the TSA the day before the sequester hit? Oh, uniforms that will be partly manufactured in Mexico? Oh, wait a minute. That's more of that mythology, isn't it? Man, this job can be so much fun sometimes. It really can. You know, because I am truly entertained by some of the nonsense I hear from these lefties. Oh yeah, speaking of lefties, I'm going to get into this in just a little while, but I got one of the best sound bites ever from Martin O'Malley.
If we want better results, we must make better choices.
That's what I said about the last election you were involved in, Governor. Anyway, I'll get into more of that a little later on. Oh, you know, you can't make this stuff up. Every day there's something new, there's something exciting. By the way, I don't know if you caught it or not, but have you been following the story of the 7-year-old who was kicked out of school for munching his Pop-Tart into the shape of a gun? Yeah. Mm-hmm. More on that coming up as well. In just a little while, stay right here, 327, 730 AM, 102.9 FM, WTNT. It's Andy Parks live from the Washington Times. It's Andy Parks live from the Washington Times on 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. And I'm joined now by Matt Sella, the editor at the Metro Desk. Good afternoon.
Well, hello there.
Preparing for the snow, perhaps?
We are preparing for the snow.
But right now, we really don't know exactly what's going on.
Snow will be a lot to talk about tomorrow, I got
a
feeling.
Yeah, I guess. What are we talking about today?
We're talking about guns today.
Okay.
Out in Annapolis, first of all, we had our third big gun rally. They've had a few of those out there. You know, the Maryland legislature is considering this gun control bill, Governor Martin O'Malley's, and it's drawn a lot of opponents, and the rallies don't necessarily seem to have gotten a lot of traction with the legislators. The gun bill passed the Senate. It's being debated in the House now, and it pretty much looks like it's going to pass there, although some things, like a provision that would require fingerprints for licenses, we're still not sure about. We'll see how that works its way through committee and through the amendment process. But where some of these people might be, you know, making some progress is in this grassroots organizing, because if this bill passes, you know, in Maryland, they've got that 30-day rule where you can collect enough signatures to go to referendum.
Right.
And I think that's what people are really looking at here, and what some of this activism might be leading toward is the referendum process.
Yeah.
If they were able to gather enough signatures, and I guess for the last election, we saw a referendum on a couple of different subjects, and it required about 55,000 signatures, which isn't a whole lot statewide.
Sure.
They could put off any gun control legislation that's passed until fall of 2014.
Wow.
So I think that's what they're really hoping for when they organize like this, is to network and get ready to gear up for the referendum process.
Yeah, I know Martin O'Malley doesn't like that idea because that begins to encroach on his presidential campaign.
Yeah.
You know. But hey. All right, what else you have?
Well, we're still talking about guns. We'll move over to the district. A bill introduced today by council member Mary Che would require a $250,000 insurance policy for gun owners. You know, this idea of insurance policies for gun owners has been batted around in a couple other places. I think this year, half a dozen states, including Maryland, were considering bills that would require some form of insurance. Didn't pass anywhere. It hasn't passed anywhere yet.
Yeah.
But different states are looking at it. And, you know, supporters say it's a financial incentive for gun owners to act responsibly with their guns, and the people who have gun accidents would then sort of be priced out of gun ownership. But opponents say, you know, this is just another unnecessary obstacle to people exercising their Second Amendment rights.
Sure.
But, you know, if something like this were to pass anywhere across the country, you'd have to say that the odds are pretty good in the district with their fairly tight.
But this is definitely an issue that would end up in the Supreme Court.
I don't think passage would be the end of it. I think I think there'd be a lot more say in the courts. That's something to be considered.
Yeah. All right, Matt, thanks for the update.
You bet.
Matt Sella, editor from the Metro Desk here at the Washington Times, 3:34, 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. Welcome back, 3:36, 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. Andy Parks live from the Washington Times. And joining me now, Jennifer Harper from Inside the Beltway. Hello.
Why, hi there, Andy Parks.
Polly want to sequester? Networks are parrots. Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, I just simply love this statement that came from our friend Brent Bozell over at the Media Research Center, and I really wanted to do this. When I...
Why are you bringing those birds in here, by the way? Me that you're bringing these birds in here.
Jojo and Frank.
And they're going to spend the show, you know, sitting in the studio here, and I've yet to see them.
Shriek.
And have you seen the birds yet?
No.
No, of course not.
This is my cockatiels, everybody.
Do they make a mess?
No. They have little travel cages, so
Yes. Okay. I mean, like, you see, I'm looking up, and I have, like, these bars up there that they could actually land and sit on these bars up here.
I don't think you want to let them out.
You don't?
No.
Okay, because they go crazy?
They would get...
Uh-oh. Your microphone just went crazy. Your microphone just fell over. Yeah, it's pretty funny.
State-of-the-art equipment here, folks.
Yeah. What happened? It just kind of...
Matt Sella did that. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, here we go. This is Brent Bozell and the Media Research Center actually went over all 88 sequestration stories.
Mm-hmm.
God, that's a weird word.
Yeah.
That ran on ABC, CBS, and NBC leading all the way up till Friday when the cuts went into effect, and discovered that 66% of them all advanced the hysteria coming out of the White House.
Of course they did. Of course they did. And you know what's so funny? Afterward, a lot of them have remained strangely quiet because they haven't really seen the effects of it. You know, the world is coming to an end, coming to an end, coming to an end, and it didn't end.
Yeah, they pointed out that people like Charlie Rose said that troops would pay for the sequester with their lives, things
right.
like that. Mm-hmm. And Brent Bozzelli is the director of the Media Research Center, longtime conservative watchdog group. He said, like squawking parrots.
Yeah.
ABC, CBS, and NBC mindlessly repeated the administration's phony, overhyped, doomsday talking points.
Yeah.
They are beyond shame and fully devoted to pushing Obama's message.
Of course they are. Even Obama, you know, he was talking, remember he was at the Capitol and he said, the janitors here tomorrow may not have jobs or something. And, you know, then the guy in charge of all the janitors had to send out like an emergency email all of his employees going, no, that's not true. That's not true. You will have a job. You will be working tomorrow. So the president stood right there and lied. And, you know, and then the media just eats it up. They just run with it. Whatever he says, yep, that's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Well, 66% of those stories did exactly that.
Yep.
They went, wah!
That's it. Okay. All right. Half of Americans don't know what a sequester is.
Yeah,
that
well, you know,
surprise.
You got to tell you, there that is a big surprise.
You know, I don't know why they just didn't say mandatory spending cuts. You know, I don't know why they went through this little, you know, sequester business stuff.
Yeah. They borrowed it. They borrowed it from what, jury duty? I'm not really sure myself. but anyway, a Gallup poll, and this was released yesterday, and actually this poll was brought up at the White House gaggle today. But anyway, 51% of Americans say they do not know enough about the sequester to say if it's a, quote, good thing or a bad thing for the nation.
And believe me, and that's what the Obama administration was banking on.
I think you're right.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're right. And someone brought that up at the White House today, one of the reporters, and spokesman said, I haven't seen that, Paul,
but
I'll think about it.
All right. Who's not coming to CPAC?
Yeah, have you been following this sort of soap opera that's going on with who's coming and who's not coming?
Well, yeah. Al Cardenas yesterday afternoon said he wanted to apologize personally to the 314-plus million people who were not invited to CPAC. Because this is all nonsensical stuff.
I mean,
you know, this whole Chris Christie deal... Ben Carson is coming. Chris Christie's not coming.
Right.
Mitt Romney is coming. I mean, it's just, you know, who cares?
Yeah. Well, some people do care. And certainly yesterday, Pamela Geller, I don't know if you've spoken with her lately. She has been a longtime, very outspoken opponent of radical Islam and all that goes with it, the Ground Zero Mosque and things like that. And
mm-hmm.
she has been appearing at CPAC for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, this was at her own blog, said, I applied to speak and was ignored. I tried to get a room for an American Freedom Defense Initiative event, the War on Free Speech, and was ignored for the first time in 5 years. I won't be at CPAC. And, you know, Mr. Cardenas was asked all about this, and I think... he cited civility as being a factor in some of the folks not returning.
Yeah, you know, and to Al, yeah, I have to come to Al's defense
because
he said, you know, yesterday in talking to him, and he said this in the past, look, we don't have room for everyone, and those who do speak there from time to time will not be invited back, but they might be invited back the year after. So, you know, don't take it personally.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that some of these people, I believe, they think that once they get in there, it's a free ticket.
Yeah.
They're there the rest of their life. Every year they're going to go there and they're going to speak, and that's just not the way it is. And he made that perfectly clear.
Yeah, well, it is the 40th CPAC. It's a big hoop-de-doo down at the beautiful Gaylord Hotel on the banks of the Potomac River.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, too, that as people parse out who's coming and who's not going, there are some folks, you know, for example, GOP Proud, that's the gay Republican group, are not going, and that created some kerfuffle about 2 weeks ago. And some factions say we need to embrace everybody as 2014 approaches, no matter who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And others are saying, no, hold with whatever your traditional beliefs are, blah, blah, blah. So interesting little secret storm evolving there.
China Goes Hollywood seeks American scriptwriters, eh?
Yeah. This is unprecedented.
Mm-hmm.
Beijing, this is China, this is what they have to say. Two great competitions. You could win an expense-paid week in Beijing and a chance at $15,000 grand prize. You could see your short film produced. 100 great prizes in all, no entry fee. Don't miss out. Andy, this is coming from the Cultural Assets Office of the Beijing Municipal Government that is state-owned. They have announced a 2013 Beijing Beijing International Screenwriting Competition.
I'll be doing.
It has to be about Beijing. They want Americans to write it. They have some American producers who are going to judge this.
Wow.
And this is the...
They can actually have like a movie made in China.
I tell you, if you're a screenwriter, go for it. Why not? Contest
chairman.
Do you
have to know Chinese?
I don't think so. Okay. This is what a spokesman says. This competition is one of the first established routes for U.S. filmmakers to obtain direct access to the Chinese market, which is huge. They are the second largest watchers of movies on the planet. Huh. They loved Avatar. That was one of their movies that they adored. They didn't get some of our movies, but they adored that.
Huh.
If you're curious about this, if you have a college student who pines to do this, you can go to writebeijing.org. It's
all
a strange little phenomenon.
Very good.
It's coming right up.
You're going to do any
research? I know someone in Hollywood who's going to do it.
Oh,
and,
you do?
And the interesting thing is they're rushing this thing right along. The proposals are due the first week of April.
Wow,
so
better get busy.
Go for it.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right, Huckabee suggests he could solve sequester over some fried pies.
Yes, I always pay attention when Mr. Huckabee speaks because it's often around the Cracker Barrel style stuff. And if you recall, maybe you don't recall, once upon a time, the actress of vintage Hollywood, Betty Davis, once said, "If you want something done right, get three old broads to do it." That's what she said.
Yeah, I have heard that somewhere along the line.
Oh, that's pretty good. Mm-hmm. Well, Mike Huckabee thinks that the entire sequester crisis or non-crisis could be solved by six old governors. He is proposing that himself and six former governors, three from each party, he says, should be sat down, given 2 hours and lunch. And he says they'll find out that they can cut the 2.4% that President Obama cuts before the fried pies arrive. Just give them
okay.
2 hours.
Everybody can do it. Everybody says
well,
they can fix
it. Well, he said when I was governor of Arkansas, I had to cut spending by 10%.
Right.
Somehow schools stayed open and police still answered calls. That's what he used to say. But give the man a fried pie and six old governors.
There we go.
And they'll solve the problems of the world. And
America's problems will be handled.
There you go.
All right, very good. Come back and bring some of those fried pies tomorrow.
That sounds good. Right? I'll warm them up and hopefully we'll get through the snow. And by the way, do you have your toilet paper and milk ready to sell out?
Yeah,
I'm
selling out
of
the trunk of my car.
Okay.
I have bread, milk, and toilet paper. Open for business at about 6 o'clock tonight when I get off the air. So anybody interested, you know where I am.
Candy bar.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye. There she goes, Jennifer Harper from Inside the Beltway, 346, 730 AM, 102.9 FM, WTNT. Andy Parks live from the Washington Times. Welcome back, 348, 730 AM, 102.9 FM, WTNT. Andy Parks live from the Washington Times. It's Tuesday. It's almost 4 o'clock. That means it's time for Jim Robbins with the Robbins Report. Hello, Jim.
Hey, Andy.
Not bluffing on Iran. Barack Obama's threats to use military force to prevent Iran securing a nuclear weapon are more than idle bluffs. That comes from Vice President Joe Biden, who was talking to the biggest pro-Israeli lobbying group on Monday. You were there, right?
Yes, I was there. I saw the speech, amazingly gas-free speech from the vice president. And, that's what he said. Of course, if you keep saying you're not bluffing, after a certain point, people have to wonder why you keep repeating it.
Yeah. Although I question as to whether or not he said everything perfectly, because I have this little soundbite from Monday. I don't know if you remember this.
Our deep commitment to the security of the state of Israel. That has not changed. That will not change as long as I and he are president and vice president of the United States.
Well, okay. Pretty close to perfect, but...
I was grading on a scale, really.
With him, you have to. That's for sure. Oh, man. I sometimes question as to why he would even be sent to that, to make the speech. Because I don't know if he's the right guy or not.
The president wasn't available because he was, working on this whole sequestration thing. telling the White House staff, you know, the tour guides to go home. And
yeah, stuff. Yeah. How about that for a story? Isn't that great?
Yeah.
We've gone that low now that we have to send tour guides home at the White House. All right. Latest on North Korea. They've vowed to cancel the 1953 ceasefire that ended the Korean War. And, of course, they're going to punish the U.S. And the U.N. for sanctions, I guess. But this is more about a joint military drill that's coming up on the, I think it's March 11th, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, they keep threatening things like this. It's not the first time that they've done this. And canceling a 60-year-old armistice, it's mostly a symbolic act if they actually did it. I think in the past they've actually said it was over and then brought it back. But whether that means anything, I don't know. I really doubt it. Are they going to cancel the armistice and then what, attack? Is that their plan? Because if they did that, it would be the end of the world for them.
Yeah, I think you're right. And even Dennis Rodman wouldn't be able to go back there.
Well, I know. I think we need to get him back over there and find out what's going on in that country.
He's the only guy I know that, according to at least one former State Department official, said he knows more about Kim Jong-un than anyone.
I'd say he was the Jane Fonda of our times, if anyone really gave a damn.
Yeah, true. All right, Chinese general to the Pentagon. I don't know if you saw this story or not, but this is a guy who once threatened to use nuclear weapons against hundreds of U.S. cities. He's going to be visiting the Pentagon this week as part of a U.S.-China military exchange program. Who knew?
Well, you know, the Chinese are our friends, Andy, so all that killing hundreds of millions of views, just, you know, that was just talk. But,
yeah.
Back when I worked for the government, we attended this thing where there was a visiting Chinese delegation just like this, and they gave a big presentation about the friendship between the U.S. and communist China dating back for, you know, to the beginning, and they completely skipped over the Korean War. No mention of it, nothing. You know, when we were killing each other by the hundreds and thousands. So, you know, it's all about just, you know, they say, oh, yeah, we threatened to kill you, but whatever.
I just finished reading a story by Sean Waterman here at the Washington Times. He says that China's national defense budget has been anted up another, 10 or 11% this year. They're one of the few nations on Earth that continue to get their military more powerful, and we're one of the others that is kind of decimating our own.
You know, they're upgrading their nuclear forces, they're talking about going to the moon, they're building aircraft carriers, they're upgrading their air force. At some point, someone in the administration is going to ask, why are they doing all that stuff?
Yeah.
They may not like the answer.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about the sequester a little bit. I know that you have been affected by all of these sequester cuts that have come down over the past 72 to 96 hours, whatever it is. Can you tell me about the long lines you've experienced anywhere?
Yeah, it's funny. I dropped off a friend of mine at Dulles Airport today. We're expecting to see, you know, lines out the door. The place was a ghost town. I don't know what they're talking about with all this stuff. I think that, you know, we saw the release of that email today from the administration saying that, you know, instructing people, make sure the sequester cuts hurt. You know, when people are trying to mitigate it and make sure that it doesn't, but because the president said it was going to hurt, it has to hurt. You know, I don't really think that they're treating this very seriously.
Yeah, and you know, yesterday I played a couple of sound bites from people like Chris Matthews, who were more worried about the president's image being tarnished by these cuts not really punishing Americans than they were about punishing Americans.
Yeah, it's funny how it's all about Obama. You know, and it's all about his image and whether they can back up his claims of the apocalypse. And meanwhile, the Dow Jones hits an all-time high. I mean, there's a definite disconnect between the administration and reality.
Yeah, that's true. All right, we're talking about, you know, security lines at airports. And I don't know if you caught this story, but evidently the TSA will again allow people to carry small pocket knives onto passenger planes and hockey sticks, plastic wiffle ball style bats, even golf clubs, you'll be able to carry on your airplane.
Wow, you know, I feel a lot less safe because someone's bringing a wiffle ball bat onto an airplane. You know, Andy, I mean, we're old enough to remember back when you could smoke on a plane.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just, you know how times have changed? Like, did anyone ever think back in the day that someone was going to, like, take out their lighter and just light the plane on fire, which they easily could have done?
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the problem is a problem of our times. So I'm glad that TSA is allowing wiffle ball bats back on board. You know, are we making progress? Who knows?
Yeah. All right. I noticed that you had a piece in USA Today. Does Iran already have the bomb? Well, I'll ask you the question. Do they?
Well, it's just an interesting question. Because of the type of bomb that they tested, this was a few weeks ago, some trace elements that were found that indicated it was a uranium bomb, which is what the Iranians are developing as opposed to plutonium, which the North Koreans have. But the main purpose of that piece was to draw attention to the fact that North Korea and Iran are in cahoots on this nuclear development. And so when North Korea gets away with it every time, like they have been, that just gives the Iranians more heart, it gives them more encouragement, and if they are going to test a nuclear weapon, the Iranians, I mean, they should do it in North Korea so that they can keep their program secret until such time as they can build up enough of a stockpile that they can say, okay, we have the bomb, what are you going to do about it?
Mm-hmm. Secretary of State John Kerry is concerned and actually made mention of that this week. I'm somewhat surprised he's already on top of this. How about you?
Oh, well, he probably read my article. But...
yeah, that's right. You know, I was reading Jim Robbins' article in USA Today. I read it before. I didn't read it.
Yeah, he and I are best buddies. But seriously, you know, between that, it's like the line now that and the vice president's statement, but it's all in the context of Mr. Obama's upcoming visit to Israel, where Iran is no doubt going to be the main issue.
Yep, that's for sure. All right, well, listen, out of time for this week. Always great to talk to you. We'll do it again next Tuesday. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, Andy.
Jim Robbins with the Robbins Report, 357, 730 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. It's Andy Parks live from the Washington Times.
And now, more of Andy Parks live from the Washington Times.
Welcome back, 406, 730 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. Andy Parks, live from the Washington Times. Great to have you along on this Tuesday afternoon. I noticed that the Dow has hit a new all-time high. The market closing just about 7 minutes ago. Wow. 14,253. That beats the old record by what? About 90 points, something like that. And it's the highest the market has been since October 9th, 2007. Wow. They contribute a lot of what's been going on in the stock market to some good news for a change coming out of Europe and some real strong economic news coming out of China. So, hey, who knew? Who knew that the market would be doing so well? Can it last? That would be the next question. We'll see. All right, guns still in the news, and Britain's anti-gun nut, Piers Morgan of CNN, express frustration with the fact that the NRA, you ready for this? The NRA will be sponsoring a NASCAR race coming up in Texas. Now, Piers was not real happy about this. He spoke with Texas State Senator Dan Patrick last night on CNN.
Tell me why this is a good idea. See, I'm slightly baffled that you can't have a tobacco company sponsoring this race because presumably it's deemed bad for Americans' health. But you can have now the NRA, which is basically funded by gun manufacturers.
Well, first of all, tell me what's bad about it. I mean, Texans love guns. Texans love fast cars. There is nothing wrong with NASCAR, and they have been involved with the NRA before. This is the first time the NRA has stepped up to the Sprint Cup Series, which is the top league. But there's nothing wrong with this, Pierce. I mean, I really don't understand anyone who would want to argue with the Bill of Rights, the First Amendment and the Second Amendment. They kind of go together well here. So I really don't understand the fuss. Tell me what your problem is. I don't get it.
My only problem is I can't understand the difference between a tobacco company not being allowed to sponsor this race because it's deemed bad for American health, and yet a gun company, effectively what the NRA is, which is funded almost predominantly now by gun manufacturers, is using this to sell more guns. I just can't imagine that guns are better for American health than tobacco.
Piers.
You're an unbelievably stupid man, aren't you?
Yes, you are. Yes, you are, Piers, because obviously the NRA is not owned by gun companies, and it's not really a gun company in and of itself, despite what you say. The NRA is a reputable institution that has been around for years and years and years, long before you, and has done outstanding work, particularly when it comes to promoting gun safety. For you to compare what the NRA does to what the tobacco industry has done, it's just it's apples and oranges. He compares tobacco and guns. Tobacco is bad for your health. Guns, one could argue, are not bad for your health. In fact, in Texas, there's every reason to believe guns are actually good for your health, something that the senator tried to explain to Mr. Morgan.
Today, and I sit on finance and I sit on criminal justice, we are closing down prisons in Texas. Crime is down. People carrying guns in Texas, concealed carry, which we talked about on your last show, has a positive impact. I can assure you in Chicago, where they have tight gun laws, they're not closing down jails. They're opening up jails. But in Texas, we actually have 12,000 beds now that are freed up because crime is down in Texas. So fast cars, guns, Texas, it all works together.
It all works together in Texas. Why is it Texas gets it? And Piers Morgan obviously doesn't. Speaking of guns, Dr. Ben Carson was asked about his position on guns when he sat down with Glenn Beck. Now, his answer may not fly with everyone. That's for sure. Check this out.
Guns, there's a reason for the Second Amendment. People do have the right to have weapons. With this argument that's going on, the way we solve it is we ask, what is each side afraid of? And then we address it that way.
Do I have a right to own a semi-automatic weapon?
It depends on where you live, I think. I think if you live in the midst of a lot of people, and I'm afraid that that semi-automatic weapon is going to fall into the hands of a crazy person, I would rather you not have it. If you live out in the country somewhere by yourself, I have no problem.
Is that a government, the federal government, or the local government that can decide that?
I think it'd probably be a local.
Mm-hmm. See, this is where I think Dr. Ben Carson walks a very tricky line. I don't like the idea that he's going to make a determination as to who can and cannot have a gun based on geography. You know, I think he may be a little lost on this issue, and it's a shame because up to this point I think he made a lot of sense, but to allow one law-abiding citizen the right to have a gun and another law-abiding citizen not to have a gun based on geography simply doesn't work with me. Just, you know, the way I feel about it. By the way, I talked about some good news when it comes to guns. There was a story this afternoon where a bank was being robbed. A man walked in, put a gun in the face of a teller. She jumped away, ended up on the floor, and one of her fellow workers grabbed his .357 and shot the robber of the bank. I always love a happy ending, don't you? Man, oh man. And speaking of guns, this could be the worst example of what the left can become I've ever heard of. Listen to this. And I know some of you may have heard this. This is the story of Josh Welch. He's a second grader in Anne Arundel County, Maryland. Goes to Park Elementary School. He was thrown out of school for 2 days, suspended, because he supposedly chewed on his Pop-Tart and, according to the teacher, shaped it into a gun. Now, Josh said, well, I really wasn't trying to do that. I was trying to make it into the shape of a mountain, but it didn't work too well. So on Friday, the Park Elementary School in Anne Arundel County, Maryland, sent a note to parents explaining this horrible incident. Josh's father, by the way, calls this suspension insanity. And it is insanity. This is what our school systems have become? Really? I mean, you know, we got a bunch of liberals running these operations, but you got a kid, a 7-year-old kid eating a Pop-Tart, and because what's left of it looks like a gun, he gets thrown out of school for 2 days? Are you serious? And the principal of the school? Yeah, it's not just a teacher going down the hall and telling the principal. It's the principal. What kind of idiot is the principal? You take a 7-year-old and you throw him out of school for 2 days because of a Pop-Tart? And that's not the first one we've heard. You know, we heard about the kid making the sign, you know, with his thumb and his forefinger. You know, like, hey, this is a gun, you know, here, boom, boom. He gets fired, suspended for that. I mean, this is how crazy the left has become. I don't know. I don't know where we go from here. You know, I don't know what the next step is some days. You know, when you walk in and you see stories like that time and time again, you have to wonder, where are we going in this country? It's not up, that's for sure. 4:14, 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. It's Andy Parks live from the Washington Times. One more thing before I take a break. I see where the Washington Examiner has a story today about vanity license plates. The ones you can't have if you live in the District of Columbia. Among the banned plates, the word freedom. You can't have freedom as your license plate. Why? Well, obviously, it's offensive to someone. Other license plates you can't have in the district include Tax Killer, spelled T-A-X-K-L-L-R, Tax R Us, T-A-X-R-U-S. You can't have the tag that says Obama, Barack, or Obama 44. And there are thousands of others on the list. The tags you cannot have if you own a vehicle and it's registered in the District of Columbia. It's quite the list. If you have the opportunity, you may want to check that out. All right, I want to get to Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley in just a little while. He's done something crazy. I know that's hard to believe. Hard to believe. This man, he's trying to follow in the footsteps of Barack Obama. There is not one tax he does not love. He wants more revenue, more revenue, more revenue. That's the way they say it, instead of more taxes. You know, if you say you want higher taxes, higher taxes, higher taxes, that scares people. But if you say we need more revenue for investments, that sounds a whole lot better. And O'Malley's getting real good at it. And this time he may have gone a little too far. We'll explain it all in just a little while. 4:17, 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. Andy Parks live from the Washington Times. It's Andy Parks live from the Washington Times on 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. And it's a pleasure to welcome to the program Chris Jankowski, president of the Republican State Leadership Committee. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Andy. Thanks for having us here.
No, my pleasure. I'm going to ask you first some basic questions, if you don't mind. What is the RSLC and what's the mission?
Sure. We are a Republican committee based here in Washington, D.C., but focused on state level. And we are responsible for electing Republicans to office at all offices below governor. So lieutenant governor, Republican attorney generals, all the Republican legislatures, and even Republican secretaries of state. That's our mission. We're also focused on building our party and strengthening our party at the grassroots level by getting folks elected to office for the first time and putting them on that escalator to higher office.
Yeah, you mentioned attorneys general. There were a bunch of them in town last week, and some of them running around this building, and some of them sitting right where you're sitting today. So they've got a lot of work cut out for them, and they've got a lot of projects ahead of them.
We think they are the last line of defense against the Obama administration's overreach and the federal overreach. And it's really a matter of law, not policy, to them. Policy should be left to legislatures and Congress, and the law and the Constitution should be enforced by the state attorney generals, and that's what the role they see, regardless of the policy outcome.
We got a pretty good one right in our area, Ken Cuccinelli. He's a pit bull. That's what
I
call him.
He is. He's strong. We're looking forward to him being governor of Virginia.
All right. So how did your organization get started?
Well, it was founded because this is somewhat technical, but McCain-Feingold legislation took the national committees of both parties out of the soft money business, the corporate money, the non-federal money, and limited them. And they're very narrowly focused now on federal efforts and broader party building stuff, but they're limited. So on both the Democrat and the Republican side, you saw the state groups kind of go out on their own. And so this group was founded over 10 years ago and has quietly built a record. We raised $39 million last cycle.
Wow.
We spend over 70 cents on every dollar directly back into a state election, and the rest goes to the fundraising cost to raise that money.
Mm-hmm.
So we work very closely with the Republican Governors Association. We're structured the same way, but we take everything below governor on the state level.
All right. Now, would it be wrong to call your organization sort of a farm club for?
We like to think we're the farm team. We're an independent committee, and we have a board of directors led by Ed Gillespie, former RNC chairman.
Sure. Talked to him many times.
And so we have some folks that know what party building looks like and can oversee our efforts, but we fundamentally are there to serve our electeds down ballot and help them win re-election and increase their numbers.
All right. The talk recently has been the need for the Republican Party to become more inclusive. Minorities, changes in the way the Republican Party does business. Do you guys take a look at that as well?
Well, actually, last cycle, we started the Future Majority Project, which is aimed at recruiting more Hispanic candidates to office. We also have the Right Women Right Now Project, which is about identifying and electing more women to office as Republicans. We try to stay in our strength, in our area that we know how to do, and that is recruiting and electing Republicans down ballot. That's what we do.
Mm-hmm.
So we saw this weakness, and it's a we have a weaker performance among certain demographic groups, and our role in this problem is to go out and find the next Marco Rubio, the next Susana Martinez, who are powerful voices and symbols for our party. Our principles don't change. What we stand for, I believe, are timeless principles in the Republican Party of conservatism. And I think that making sure that we have the right messengers will go a long way to impacting conservative policy.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Chris Jankowski, president of the Republican State Leadership Committee. Karl Rove's organization, as an example, has come under fire recently for choosing the candidate for the people. You've heard a little bit of that, I would assume. How does your organization differ? You don't go out and actually select the candidate for the voter, do you? You what? You try to help the one that has the best shot?
Absolutely. We are focused on beating the Democrats, and we have a pretty good record of doing that on the state level, and we have the majorities on the state level in many offices. We believe that, contested primary can often make a stronger, better candidate for the general election.
Mm-hmm.
There are instances where we're out recruiting candidates, but we don't engage in primaries, and we'll support the Republican nominee.
I got you. Okay. Your organization, not affiliated with the RNC?
No, and can't be under that McCain-Feingold
I got you.
Bill. So we are separate. We consider the RNC a partner, and in some areas we can partner, but we are separate.
Mm-hmm. How are you funded?
We are, of that $39 million, I would say companies, businesses of all sizes and organizations probably provide about 80% of it, and then the other 20% comes from individual donors. We have over 50,000 individual donors from around the country over the last 10 years, so it's a mix. And there are people that believe in our broader mission and see the good we're doing at a lower level. It doesn't get all the limelight that you get here in Washington, but we're proud of our record, and we're attracting more and more financial support every day.
All right, so how do people help?
www.rslc.com. You can go
pretty
there
easy,
and rslc.com. Please visit our website, learn more about our record, and if you can help us, please help us.
Yeah. All right, and one final question. What can you do to help me in my state of Maryland? Tell me to move?
Well, I think it's important that Republicans continue to have a very clear message and a contrast.
I feel lost in that state. I hope you know that.
Well, I'm a Maryland native, and I won't abandon my home state. I come from a family of Democrats, but I'm convinced that my grandparents wouldn't recognize the Maryland Democratic Party as it is today.
That is exactly right, because I come from a family of Democrats, and the party is nowhere what it once was, that's for sure. All right, well, listen, keep up the good work, and come back and see me again.
Thanks, Andy.
All
great
right.
to be here.
Chris Jankowski, president of the Republican State Leadership Committee. 426, 730 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. It's Andy Parks live from the Washington Times. 4:28, 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT, Andy Parks, live from the Washington Times. Well, what would be the first thing you would do if you signed a new contract worth $120 million as the Baltimore Ravens quarterback Joe Flacco did yesterday? Keep in mind, he picked up a check, a signing bonus, of $29 million. And $52 million of that $120 million contract is guaranteed money. What did he do? He went to McDonald's. And he bought the 10-piece McNugget meal for just $6.99. Yep, 2 hours after signing this massive 6-year deal, Joe Flacco, sitting at a McDonald's, even posed for a picture at the McDonald's drive-thru in Aberdeen, Maryland. I guess we don't have to worry about him spending too much money, do we? Yeah, kind of a down-to-earth guy. Good for him. All right, stay tuned. More to come. We'll get a web desk update with WashingtonTimes.com homepage editor Doug Ernst in just a minute. And political editor Stephen Diner will be along in a few. We've got lots to talk about, including a curious email from the White House. Stay tuned for that. Welcome back. 4:31, 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. Andy Parks live from the Washington Times. And joining me now, the homepage editor from WashingtonTimes.com, Doug Ernst. Hello, Doug.
Hello.
You guys busy?
Of course.
Yeah.
Every day.
What are you working on?
News doesn't stop. Well, the Dennis Rodman controversy never ends. Shaquille O'Neal, famous NBA baller from, Lakers and Orlando Magic.
Yeah.
He actually weighed in, and he says, quote, "I think as people, we should understand our roles in life, and I think certain people should leave the diplomacy to the diplomats." It was a very, very risky move, what he did.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
he left
open the window. He said certain people. So I have this feeling if Dennis was actually halfway intelligent, he probably wouldn't care about it.
Yeah.
But, when you go around, carrying the water for crazy dictators, and maybe you're not making the NBA look so
well,
hot.
And I tried to make sense of some of what he said on ABC's This Week, and quite frankly, there was a lot of incoherent rumbling at times, so really, just stay away. let others deal with that. Although sometimes, with the crazy people, crazy dictators, you want to fight fire with fire.
Well, sometimes depending on who the diplomat is, they don't really do that much of a better job than Dennis Rodman.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, what else?
Well, speaking of diplomats, Secretary of State John Kerry, he confirms that U.S. forces are currently training rebel forces in Syria, although he would not provide details as to what exactly that training was.
Huh.
I don't know if it's, military operations and urban warfare and urban training or what.
Yeah.
They just said we're training forces. But I guess the question is, who are the rebels? Are these, we have bad guys and then worse bad guys? Or good guys?
Yeah.
I mean, after...
They're the good bad guys. See, that's
right.
The way I look at it, because sometimes you encounter that. What that leads to down the road is anyone's guess. Now, if I understand correctly, the aid is not military weaponry. It's just help. Like you just mentioned, right?
Right. I don't know if it's just logistics or
the
extent to what they're training. They've been kind of shadowy about what they're providing.
And I'm sure there's some money involved,
Money
we don't have right now, but, that doesn't mean anything in this day and age. All right. What else?
Well, that dovetails nicely with speaking about details. The coalition in Afghanistan will no longer tally or publish Taliban attacks. And this comes after, you know, a week ago, I think it was, they acknowledged that they had said there was a 7% drop in attacks. Well, really, there wasn't any drop.
Oh.
So now, as we draw down forces, they're just not going to provide any details on attacks. And it's, to me, it's one of those things where it's like, if we just declare that we won or the war's over,
yeah,
that means we won, but it doesn't acknowledge that, you know, your enemy kind of has say in whether or not a war is over.
Yeah. We can't get out of there fast enough.
It's
unfortunate.
Afghanistan has historically been a graveyard of empires, yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah. All right, one more.
All right. Sorry, it was on CPAC, CPAC News. Donald Trump is, I guess, officially in.
Oh.
But Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell is out, and he's been kind of under fire recently for this transportation bill where sales tax went from 5 to 6%.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
There's a wholesale price on gas that went from 3.5%. It is 3.5%. That's what it'll be. And then there's also a car tax that went from 3% to 4.3% in Virginia. I know you said you were going to talk about O'Malley raising taxes. It just seems like escape the taxes.
No, and it's funny that you say that because McDonald did go under the gun for doing what he did, especially in a time when, you know, things are tough. Virginia has actually been running surpluses. All right, so the need, a lot of people look at it and go, well, you know, you really didn't have to do that right now. And the other drawback is that Martin O'Malley loved that idea. When the two appeared side by side on one of the Sunday shows, the first thing O'Malley did is congratulate McDonald on what he had done.
Which
to me says, uh-oh, that probably wasn't a good thing Bob McDonald just did if Martin O'Malley is congratulating him for it. And sure enough, what do we hear last night? Martin O'Malley is taking the same route, but to a larger extent, if I understand.
Right. I did hear about Terry McAuliffe endorsing those ideas, and that's also kind of a bad signal.
Yeah, it is a bad signal. So, I mean, I certainly understand. I talk to Al Cardenas of the American Conservative Union every single week, and Al said, look, you know, some people don't get invited. And you know why? Because they do dumb things. Chris Christie, the reason he didn't get invited was not the fact that he stood there shaking hands with the president, you know, when he was up there for the Hurricane Sandy relief stuff. The fact is, he wasn't a true conservative when it came to the Sandy relief funding. He only needed, I say only, he needed $9 billion in Sandy relief. But he pressured the Republicans into signing this massive, bloated, $60 billion pork-laden bill, and that's why he wasn't invited to CPAC, because he wasn't being conservative. You know, he wanted his $9 billion, and it meant that we, as the American taxpayer, had to put out an additional $51 billion to get him his $9 billion. It didn't matter to him. That's why he wasn't invited to CPAC. And so maybe Bob McDonald is now falling into that category.
Outside of Reagan, I can't think of many people who would ever get a CPAC for life speaking gig.
No, I think you're absolutely right. All right, my friend, thank you. Please come back tomorrow, and we'll go to WashingtonTimes.com and check it out.
Thank you.
Doug Ernst, homepage editor, WashingtonTimes.com. That's the place to go right now. 437, 730 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. Andy Parks, live from the Washington Times. Welcome back, 439, 730 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. Stay tuned. Coming up in just a few minutes, I'll be checking in with Stephen Dinan, Washington Times political editor. A couple of big stories today. One involves an email from the White House that indicates maybe the White House really does want to see some downward pressure put on the American people so they can gloat over what the sequester is all about. Remember last week they made it sound like it was the end of the world was coming? Well, now we have an email that suggests that's exactly what they're trying to do. We'll get to Stephen about that and some other things in just a couple of minutes. In the meantime, I did want to spend a little bit of time talking about Maryland's governor, Martin O'Malley. Here's a guy, and look, I make no bones about it. I don't like him. I don't like what he stands for. I do not want to see him become president of the United States, and I'll do everything in my power to see to it that it doesn't happen. This guy is a tax and spend liberal from the word go. My feeling is he's worse than Obama ever could be, if that's even possible. This guy has never met a tax hike he didn't love. And yesterday, he and his lapdogs in Annapolis announced another reach into the pockets of Marylanders at a time when we can at least afford it. I mean, come on. Yeah, but it doesn't matter to this guy. His eyes on the White House in 2016. I'm convinced he wants to show liberals he can outspend, Obama. He can spend money with the best of them. So here's the latest. As many of you know, the Transportation Trust Fund in Maryland was sucked dry a few years ago to the tune of $800+ million by a bunch of liberal Democrats that thought the money should be used for some of their causes instead of infrastructure. And that's exactly what the money was set aside from. Transportation Trust Fund. You've heard me talking about it before. Why put the word trust in there if you can't trust the people responsible for it? But they did. And it was squandered. You know, money set aside for infrastructure. You know, the roads and the bridges that the Democrats were always crying about. We had the money. The fund was robbed, used for liberal projects, and now it comes time to replace those roads and bridges. And we have no money. Well, never fear, because Marty O stepped up to the podium and declared,
"If we want better results, we must make better choices."
It's too bad the voters didn't do that last time you were up for re-election. Make a better choice, because we had a better choice, but obviously the Democrats in Maryland decided that you were their guy. And so for the 22nd time, this governor plans to raise taxes, this time to take $3.4 billion, $3.4 billion out of your pockets over the next 5 years. Keep in mind, he already got $1 billion for this year's overbloated budget, remember? You know, when I think most Marylanders, most Americans would have been tickled if they just held the line on the budget, but he couldn't resist. He had to have more money. He had to have another $1 billion. And now he wants another $3.4 billion. He can't get enough. It's like a drug addict. He can't get enough of your money. So here's this brilliant plan, and I want you to do the math along with me if you can, okay? Here's what he says. The wholesale cost of gasoline will increase about 2 cents in July as a result of this tax. He said that equals 2 cents a gallon. Really? So either gasoline is $1 a gallon, or O'Malley got the math completely wrong. The real tax, as far as I can figure, is about 7 or 8 cents a gallon. Not 2 cents. And in the very next sentence, he says, in 2014, it would go up about 4% or 9 cents a gallon. Let's see. Let's figure the wholesale cost of gasoline is what? Let's be conservative. Right now, what, $3? $3 a gallon? 4%, $3? That's 12 cents a gallon, right? How in the world did they come up with this other stuff? I mean, seriously, how do they come up with their numbers? Where's this math come from? Does it come from the Obama budget office? And here's the other part of this. There's a perception by some that the gas is only going up on the wholesale level. Meaning what? Meaning that on the wholesale level, they're moving this tax in to the wholesale level. And that means what? The wholesaler has to pay it and then what? Pass it on to the consumer? Do you think that the wholesaler passes on exactly that amount to the consumer, or perhaps maybe just another couple cents or even a half a cent? I mean, do the math on this stuff. It doesn't add up. What does add up is the fact that this guy can't get enough of your money, and now he wants $3.4 billion over the next 5 years. At a time when we don't have it. But he doesn't care. He cares about winning the White House. That's what he cares about. 4:45, 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT, Andy Parks, live from the Washington Times. Stephen Dinan on the way. Stay right here. Welcome back, 4:47, 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. Oh, look who's on the line. It's Stephen Dinan, Washington Times political editor. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Andy.
Well, boy, I don't know where to dive in first. I guess we go right to the email, because that's quite intriguing. Give us the backstory on this. This was something about making the sequester as painful as promised?
Yeah, so this was always the decision facing the White House. They had such dire consequences that they predicted from the sequesters ahead of time. Of course, the point then was to try and make it as painful as possible, and the promise of it as painful as possible, because they still thought there was a chance to force Republicans to accept higher tax increases in exchange for getting rid of some of these cuts. Now that we're actually past that point and the cuts are here, the real question for the White House is, okay, did they actually follow through with things as dire as they warned they would be, or do they actually try and manage some of the cuts and keep some of the pain out of there as best as possible? You know, one of those is sort of the political avenue, the other is sort of the governing avenue, and they have to decide which of those they go with. So that's a prelude to an email that went out from someone in the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, which is a part of the Agriculture Department, went out on Monday, and it captured a conversation that this person had had. He'd asked his superiors, he's from the regional, Eastern Regional Office of APHIS, and he asked his superiors at the Department of Agriculture, hey, can I come up with a way to spread out some of the sequester impacts across my region so that I can actually do, it's called aquaculture, it's basically, fish farming and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Can I come up with a way to spread out the sequesters across my region so that I can still do some of the catfish farm inspections and whatnot that I need to do in order to keep some of these people, these farms actually still operating? And as he said, the word back from on high, from Department of Agriculture, was, look, we promised, we already told Congress that we would have to stop these inspections, that they would be this painful. Whatever you do to manage the sequesters, you can't do something that will contradict the pain that we told them would result.
Mm-hmm.
And this has a lot of members of Congress very worried about, okay, so this guy is coming up with a way that he thinks he can actually alter the sequesters to make them less painful, and you're telling him, no, make them as painful as we predicted they would be. That seems like it's probably a bad way to govern. And Secretary Vilsack, the Agriculture Secretary, was actually asked about this at a hearing today, and of course he didn't have knowledge of the specific memo or email, but he said, we're trying to minimize them where we can, and we've given them the authority, but that does seem to stand in contrast with this guidance that this guy said he got.
Yeah, okay, so this was reported by a guy by the name of Charlie Brown, the official at the APHIS office in Raleigh. Any guesses as to how long he'll be employed by the APHIS office?
I don't know. I've left a message for him, and I haven't heard back from him. So neither have I heard back from APHIS itself. I left a message for the administrator's office over there, and it's noteworthy that when you call the APHIS press office, the line is the voicemail box is full. So I don't know how they're managing the managing that agency, and maybe the sequesters have already hit the press office, but they have been unable to explain to me exactly what's going on there.
Mm-hmm. All right, I saw another story that you posted. More sequester pain. White House cancels tours. Really?
Yeah, this actually, the White House Visitor's Office sent out an email that somebody, I assume they'd had a tour scheduled and got this email for having a tour scheduled, but the White House announced in an email that because of the sequesters, starting next week, it would no longer be conducting tours. To people who had tours scheduled, those have been canceled, they can't reschedule them, and they will stop giving tours until further notice. And, I seem to recall that the White House canceled tours after, say, September 11th and some of the very particular danger spots we've had
sure.
in the past. But canceling them because of budgets is, I guess they have to make cuts somewhere, and maybe that's that may be sort of an easy place to make cuts. But we've also talked about the cutting the Washington Monument cuts, when you go for the really high-profile cuts in order to say this is how bad it is. Now, I also joke that I don't know if you've ever done the White House tour. It's been many, many years since I did.
Yeah,
but I actually thought that it was probably more painful to go through on the tour than to avoid it. So maybe this is sparing us pain rather than imposing.
Yeah, I get the funny feeling, though, it's more symbolic than anything else. All right, feds keep hiring with sequesters in place. Your story says 400 jobs were posted on the first day back, meaning that, hey, look, it's not hitting everybody within the federal government. They're still hiring.
Yeah, in fact, including APHIS, the inspection service we were talking about that's halting all of its aquaculture inspections, it actually has an ad up they posted yesterday for 3 insect production workers out in Phoenix. These are folks who are supposed to be incubating bollworms in order to help the cotton production out there in Arizona, and that's so. Even agencies that are in the middle of these dramatic cuts and are saying we have no flexibility are still advertising new positions, and that seems like a very interesting decision to make. You know, it's every agency is facing these tough decisions, and they have to face the choice: do we go ahead and furlough employees and cut our hours by 20%, or do we stop hiring new people? Do we take it out of attrition? I guess every place is going to come up with different ways to do that, but when you go through the list of some of the people that are being hired, you got to imagine that they might have made different decisions. For example, the Justice Department is looking for 3 librarians at salaries, I think it was up to $115,000 a person.
Wow! Are you serious?
Yeah, so 3 librarians. First of all, advertising for 3 librarians right now seems particularly interesting decision when we're talking about furloughing FBI agents and whatnot. But you know, those are the sorts of decisions that are going to get scrutinized, and that's what I was talking about earlier. When the administration has a decision to make, and if they choose to go for the high-profile pain route, then every time we see job openings, you know, we in the public see job openings for something that we're like, well, gosh, I'd rather have an FBI agent out there than another guy staffing your library. Those are the sorts of things that the administration's got to be careful of as it moves forward.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, now I'm just curious. Do we have anyone in a position in our government to determine what positions are important and what positions aren't necessarily important?
Every single agency is allowed to make those decisions.
Okay.
This is sort of the big difficulty here. I one of the guys I spoke with for that story you were just talking about is a guy named Andrew Light, who was a professor at NYU. He's also sort of the world's biggest expert on the federal government and reorganization. And he makes the point that the last time that we basically, I guess, rewrote the civil service was just after World War II in the late 1940s. So it's been 60 years since we last sort of evaluated what the civil service looks like. That means that a lot of these agencies are operating under mission descriptions that are outdated, and the job descriptions are outdated. As he put it, you know, we say that everything is mission critical, therefore it's impossible to tell what's actually mission critical. So when you're going through, you're an agency head and you're trying to decide what to cut, if you look at your mission critical description, it probably says it's critical to answer phones, and it's critical to have an agent standing on the border to prevent a terrorist from coming in. And so, well, gosh, I have to have somebody answering the phones and on the border, and those things end up being equivalent in the mission statement. And that's a problem. The main difficulty with coming up with smart cuts right now is that we think that everything the federal government does, from answering phones to defending the country, is mission critical, and therefore, how do you make any cuts?
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you something. Is there any chance that some type of deal could be worked out in the coming days or weeks that would appease everyone?
Oh, you had me until the appease everyone. there is a chance for a deal. In fact, what we are likely to see is here at the end of this month, the continuing resolution debate. Congress, the funding they passed for 2013 only went through the first 6 months of the fiscal year, which means up through the end of this month, up through March. So Congress has to pass more bills to fund the country for the final 6 months of the fiscal year, so essentially through September 30th. Inside of that, they can go ahead and rearrange how these cuts are drawn. Actually, they could cancel the cuts if they wanted, though that's unlikely to get through Congress. So they're going to most likely write bills that rearrange the cuts and try and ease the pain and give more flexibility. And so we'll see how that happens. But that's the goal. I think that's likely. That we don't see the cuts eliminated, but we do see some rejiggering.
I got you. All right, and we'll be following that as we go forward. As always, Stephen, thanks for your help on all the stories. We appreciate it.
Good to be with you.
See you. Stephen Dinan, Washington Times political editor. It is 4:57, 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. Getting word from CNN that Hugo Chavez has died. He has been ill for quite some time. A story I read earlier this afternoon said he was in grave condition, having difficulty breathing. So it appears that Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has passed away, and when we get more information on that, we'll pass that along. It is 4:58, 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT.
And now, more of Andy Parks, live from the Washington Times.
Welcome back, 5:06, 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. Andy Parks, live from the Washington Times. Welcome to Tuesday afternoon, and welcome to Jeff Cooner. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Andy.
Jeff, we got word here just a few minutes ago that Hugo Chavez has died, and if you couple this with the fact that Raul Castro says that he may be headed out of office, I think we're going to see some changes in some of these regimes that have been trouble spots for us in the past. But will it be good news or bad news? What are your thoughts?
Well, Andy, I have to say, I never like to hear the news of anybody dying, but I think Venezuelans should be dancing on his grave today. This man destroyed Venezuela. He took one of the most prosperous middle-class democracies in all of Latin America, and he ruined it, destroyed it, dismantled it step by painful step. The middle class has been wiped out. The country has been impoverished. Freedom of the press has been destroyed. Dissidents, critics of the regime, opponents of the regime are rotting in prison. Many of them have been murdered. He established a brutal socialist police state, modeling it upon Castro and what the Castro brothers have done in Cuba. So to me, this man's passing is a good thing. He was an enemy of the United States. He basically cut deals with China. He allowed the Chinese to sell him sensitive nuclear technology. He tried to help Iran build its bomb. He is somebody who's been very close with the Russians and with Vladimir Putin. He wanted to lead an anti-American Bolivarian socialist revolution across Latin America. He used Latin America's huge oil wealth to undermine neighboring countries like Colombia. He's armed the FARC rebels. This man is a very, very dangerous man. He's been giving Castro's regime financial lifeline, financial aid going back years. So I think, Andy, whatever happens, I think Venezuela will be better off. Hopefully, with the end of Chavez will come the end of Chavismo and the end of Chavezism and everything that comes with it. My concern, Andy, is that his surrogates, his lackeys, his supporters are going to want to cling to power.
Sure.
They're going to want to continue with their left-wing Marxist revolution and dictatorship. And I think the country could be split and heading off into civil war. Raul Castro is an old man. He knows he's an old man. He knows time is running out for him, for both the Castro brothers. Andy, I think this vacuum that has now been left by the death of Chavez gives the United States an opportunity to now reengage and hopefully reassert the values of freedom, democracy, across Latin America. These two regimes have been a thorn in our side long enough. They have impoverished their people long enough. And honestly, Andy, I think if Chavez is dead and if the opposition can retake their country, Cuba will again be isolated. I think the Castro's days are numbered. I think without the financial oil lifeline that Chavez gave to Havana, I don't think the Castro regime can survive. And it's crumbling. The people in Cuba are now seeing that it's crumbling. Fidel is an old, sick man. Raul is barely grasping onto the throne. I think the Castro brothers are in big trouble. And if they lose control, I think it'll be a great day for the Cuban people. I think it'll be a great day for the United States. I think it'll be a great day for freedom. And Andy, I cannot wait to see the day where Cuba becomes free.
A great day for the United States. Under normal circumstances, I would say that, but under this presidency, I don't know if they couldn't screw this up, you know?
Well, Andy, I think the first thing they're going to do is they're probably going to give their condolences. They're going to probably mourn the death of Chavez. They're probably going to push for his successor, the vice president, to take over power. In other words, they're probably going to assert and grant legitimacy to this illegitimate regime. What they should do is demand free and fair elections. They should demand that now that the dictator is gone, let Venezuela hold an honest, free, fair election. If that's the case, then Chavismo is dead. Chavez's party will be defeated. Socialism will be routed. I don't know if the administration can see this. I don't know if they want this to happen. Obama was, in fact, quite close to Chavez. He's been quite close to Castro. But this could be a domino effect. This could be the Berlin Wall, the socialist Berlin Wall in Latin America coming down. And if this is the case, Andy, I have to say I know a lot of Cuban Americans. They've been wonderful Americans, very successful Americans, many of them in South Florida. They have been itching to see the day that their ancestral homeland becomes free. And if that island prison of Cuba can finally be opened up, I think it'll be one of the greatest days of my life, Andy. So hopefully this is going to send in a domino effect that's going to be felt in Venezuela, in Bolivia, in Nicaragua, in other countries that have gone leftist and socialist, and ultimately in Havana itself.
Mm-hmm. All right, my friend, thank you. We're going to weather the snow here. I don't know if they're calling for it up in your neck of the woods or not.
Andy, honestly, I've not heard that we're getting any snow.
All right. Well, it must be something that's dedicated to the Mid-Atlantic this time around, so you'll get away with one.
I hope so, Andy. Something tells me we won't. Something tells me I'm getting snow tomorrow
yeah.
Or Friday, Andy.
There you go. All right, I'll see you later.
Take care, Andy. Bye. Bye.
That is Jeff Cooner of the Washington Times, 512, 730 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. If you're just joining in, the report came just a little while ago that Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has passed away at the age of 58. As many of you know, he has been fighting cancer for the past couple of years. He has indeed been a thorn in the side of the Western world, and so he will not be missed on a lot of levels. It's interesting to me that he was only 58 years old, been in power since 1999, and it really is a crapshoot as to where this country is going to end up now, because there was a person that was hand-selected by Chavez to kind of take over the reins. Whether or not that individual does, who knows? Now, from the standpoint of Cuba, we were talking about that with Jeff just a couple of minutes ago, it appears that Raul Castro, who has honestly almost been supported to a great degree by Chavez over the recent times, it appears that he wants to get out. He's talking about retirement. And, of course, his brother, Fidel, is in no shape to take over, and that's for sure. So it appears that another regime may be coming to an end, another thorn in our side. It'll be interesting to see how the Obama administration handles both. It is 5:13, 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT, Andy Parks, live from the Washington Times. Welcome back, 5:17, 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT, Andy Parks, live from the Washington Times. And on this Tuesday afternoon, I'm joined by Jim McElhattan, Washington Times investigative reporter. Hello, Jim.
Hey, Andy, how you doing?
I'm doing just fine. A story caught my eye this morning. Postal Service welcome kit raises questions. White House now cites Privacy Act, and it occurred to me that you and I have talked about this in the past, and if I recall correctly, it wasn't too long after I got here because I had just moved, and I said that I had one of these movers kits, one of these welcome kits from the Postal Service.
Sure.
All right, so what's new about the story?
Well, after we had done some stories, talking to some folks who raised some questions about whether this squares with the Federal Privacy Act. Under the federal law, agencies can't rent or sell people's personal information, including names and addresses. Now, under this program, when you move or you change addresses, you get this official-looking envelope in the mail, and you open it up because it's very important. It says verification required. Don't throw away official government correspondence. And you open it up, and it's a bunch of advertising. It's a coupons for cell phones, and some of them are pretty good.
Yeah.
In any case, After the story ran, we filed an open records request with the Postal Service and with the Office of Management and Budget, which oversees privacy regulations for the federal government.
Right.
OMB came back and said, we don't know what you're talking about. We don't have any records. A year later, after we file an appeal, the Postal Service comes back and gives us about 700 pages of redacted documents, including inquiries from the OMB, which had told us they didn't have any records, asking the Postal Service, saying, you know, how can you be doing this, what's the statutory authority here, asking pointed questions about the privacy practices under this program, which the Postal Service and the contractor that handles it, a Pitney Bowes subsidiary, have defended. So it was interesting to see the OMB behind closed doors raising questions when, frankly, OMB told us in response to a Freedom of Information Act request that they had no responsive documents here.
That Freedom of Information Act, that really can... That really gets them in trouble sometimes, doesn't it? All right, so what happens here? Is it this mover's welcome kit is still out there?
Sure, right? and folks love it. But there are others out there who are raising these privacy concerns. And these emails we got where OMB is asking questions, the White House is asking questions of the Postal Service, are you on solid ground here, and how can you be doing this, and tell us. The Postal Service hasn't told us how they responded. We heard from them yesterday saying we're going to get you a statement, and that was never forthcoming. Mm-hmm. And the OMB has yet to acknowledge our inquiries yesterday. So certainly... these emails reflect, a serious questions being raised by OMB privately, but publicly they haven't acknowledged.
Would this explain why I get so much junk mail now?
No, who knows? Yeah.
All right. Who's making the money out of this?
There's a company that is a subsidiary of Pitney Bowes that is the contractor for this program. They work under a 10-year contract with the Postal Service, approved about a year or two ago. And all this is this is a long-standing program that was based on an unsolicited proposal years and years ago. So essentially, the Postal Service doesn't turn over your name and address information to, say, Target or Poland Spring Water or some cell phone company. They give it to this company, which has access to it, and then this company says to these major retailers, saying, "Hey, if you want to reach movers, you better advertise with us, because we can get you in the mailboxes of people, not just as an ad, but frankly in official government correspondence. You get these ads and they're in letters from a government agency."
Well, yeah, I remember not long after I moved, I looked at some of the stuff that was in this kit and I thought, wow, I could have used this coupon, because I used one of those pods. Mm-hmm. To store
things for a little bit.
Sure. And only used it for a couple of weeks. But I mean, I don't know what it cost me. It cost me $500 or $600 to use it. And I had a coupon in there. It was worth $100 or $200.
Yeah.
And didn't know it. So, I mean, you're right. I mean, some of the stuff was, it would have been well received had I gotten it in a timely fashion. But I didn't. And that wasn't it wasn't their fault. But by the same token, I am concerned about, where's my information going outside of the Postal Service?
Sure.
So, all right. So, is there any end to this story, or are we still waiting for some other information?
I don't have any other information requests pending.
Yeah.
They redacted the heck out of a lot of the materials they gave me.
Now,
maybe we'll appeal that. all kinds of grounds, and certainly they had a good amount of things to say about the Washington Times and its coverage in these
really?
Emails.
Were you called out personally?
Oh, in fact, one of the folks that works for this company, referred. After our initial story ran, emailed a colleague in the Postal Service saying, we dodged the bullet here,
Oh, wow.
So, and I called him up yesterday and asked what he meant by that, and, he didn't elaborate.
There's a big surprise. Yeah. All right. Well, I love this kind of stuff. You know, keep me posted if you do any more on this. But this is an interesting story. It just it shows some of the inner workings of a system that we don't see every day.
Sure.
You know, and allows us a little insight as to what goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
So anyway, all right, folks. If you haven't read it, check it out. Postal Service Welcome Kit raises questions. White House now cites Privacy Act. It's by Jim McElhattan. It's in today's Washington Times. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, Andy.
See ya. 5:23, 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. Welcome back. 5:27, 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. Andy Parks, live from the Washington Times. Don't know if you caught the story, but there was a drone flying over Brooklyn yesterday afternoon. And the FAA is investigating. They want to know what happened. You see, a pilot of a Alitalia passenger jet says he saw the unmanned aircraft while landing at JFK in New York. He said, we saw a drone aircraft. He estimated that the small remote-controlled aircraft was at about 1,500 feet. He saw them on final approach to runway 31 right at JFK. And it evidently was about 200 feet above the aircraft. Now, under normal circumstances, you say, okay, could be a kid with one of these little, you know, helicopter rotor drones. Could have been, you know, some kind of police drone. But the fact is, they have no business being in the flight path of commercial airliners. And I know the average person would say, okay, well, how big was it? Well, it's just a little tiny thing, you know, a couple feet by a couple feet. But keep in mind, you know, a goose can bring down an airplane. You know, something like this, grinding this up through one of the jet's intakes, or even worse, having this make contact with the control surface of an airliner could be deadly. Really could be. And so now air traffic controllers, they have to worry about it. Obviously, pilots have to worry about it. The FAA is launching an investigation into it. I'm sure we're going to have other, you know, organizations getting involved. Police department, Port Authority, you name it. They're all going to be checking into this to find out exactly what happened. If it's some kid playing with a toy, well, that's one thing, and hopefully they can get the message out. But if it's somebody with the idea that they could do some damage to an airplane on final approach, then we've got a problem. So it's going to be interesting to see where this story goes over the next few days. It's getting some headlines, obviously, today, but when an airline pilot says, hey, you know, I saw something that was almost in my way on the way in, and the controllers couldn't see it because it was so small, that creates a problem, a big problem. 5:29, 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. Stay tuned. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, Sean Waterman, national security reporter here at the Washington Times, is working on a bunch of things, and we need to get to them all.
You should get warm. I can't believe how happy you look to be out there in the snow.
It's going to get worse.
It is definitely going to get worse. We'll be following.
I'm very happy.
Jennifer Delgado for us in Chicago. Thank you. Stay warm. Now tonight, Piers Morgan will ask the question, is global warming causing more of these massive storms? That's tonight at 9 Eastern right here on CNN.
I'm sorry. That's one of the funniest things I've heard in a while. We got a snowstorm in Chicago. This was earlier this afternoon. They go to the live shot on CNN to this young lady covering the snowstorm for them. And, of course, they tagged the story out with the fact that Piers Morgan will be talking about the storm and could it be global warming? Excuse me, it's winter time. It's in Chicago. Doesn't it snow in Chicago all the time in the winter? And because they got a foot of snow, somehow or another we're to believe that this is an effect of global warming. I can't watch. I can't watch it tonight. Ah, it's like a train wreck. I guess I'll have to. I can't wait to hear what Piers Morgan has to say about it snowing in Chicago in the wintertime and how it's related to global warming. Oh, my. It just can't get any better. Or can it? Tea Party Congressman introduces a hilarious amendment to stop Obama from golfing. That's from the Business Insider, and this was reported a short while ago. Evidently, good old Louis Gohmert of Texas, conservative congressman, actually a really good guy. He's responding to the White House canceling the tours, canceling public tours as a result of the sequester. So he called it a shameless stunt. It's the latest by this president who is twisting basic government efficiency into an extreme consequence, according to Gohmert. His measure would prohibit the White House from using any of the appropriated funds to pay for Obama's frequent golfing outings unless the tours are reinstated. None of the funds made available by a division of this act may be used to transport the president to or from a golf course until public tours of the White House resume. That's how this amendment reads that Gohmert is proposing. And the House is expected to vote on their continuing resolution bill tomorrow. So I can't wait to see how that turns out. That's a wacky world in which we live, isn't it? 4:34, 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT. We'll get to Sean Waterman in just a couple of minutes. Stay right here. It's Andy Parks, live from the Washington Times on 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT, and I'm joined now by Sean Waterman, Washington Times national security reporter. Hello, Sean.
Hello, Andy.
I have a laundry list of things to talk to you about today, and I guess we're going to begin with Congress to see secret drone memos paving path for CIA director confirmation. That's the title of the last story of yours, posted just a few minutes ago at WashingtonTimes.com. Tell me about this. How did all of this come about?
Well, this all relates to the confirmation of John Brennan, the president's top counterterrorism advisor, to be director of the CIA. And that confirmation process has been slowed by questions from both sides of the aisle about the drone program, which is probably, you know, one of the most controversial sort of counterterrorism tactics that the administration uses. And John Brennan's been, you know, in charge of it, really. So what happened today is that the chairwoman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Dianne Feinstein, said that the administration had agreed to let members of the committee see the legal opinions which underpin the president's assertion of authority that he's got the right to order these people killed, including American citizens, if they can't be captured, without any charge or trial. So these are the legal opinions that have been at the center of this row. The members of the Senate Intelligence Committee are now going to be able to see them. They will be meeting this afternoon. They're going to, expected to vote on the confirmation, refer it to the full Senate. And I think that vote will probably go through.
All right, very good. We're going to move on to something else. North Korea threatens to cancel Korean War ceasefire. That obviously gets a lot of attention. What exactly happened here, and is this a response to perhaps harsh words from adversaries like the U.S. and South Korea?
Well, it's the North Koreans themselves said it was a response to the drill, the military exercise that is planned next week in South Korea, the U.S. and South Korean forces exercising together as they do periodically. You know, there is still technically a state of war between North and South Korea. There was a truce, there was an armistice, but there wasn't actually a peace treaty. So they've just said it will be as dead in fact as it is in letter or something like that. I mean, it's the usual blood-curdling kind of rhetoric. But another reason I think why they're so kind of, well, they're upping the ante like this is they're very worried about what's happening at the United Nations, where China has finally signed on to a new package of sanctions against North Korea. You know, the international community really punishing it for this nuclear test it carried out last month. Now, these sanctions target, according to the, you know, the preliminary reports that we're getting, according to Susan Rice, the U.S. ambassador at the U.N., she said that these sanctions will target North Korean diplomats and the bulk cash and other criminal activities, which basically is, you know, an important income stream for the regime because, you know, this is a country where people routinely are reduced to eating bark and grass. It's an economic basket case, and one of the major income streams that the regime has is, forged U.S. $100 bills, drugs, and other kinds of illegal activities that are facilitated, it is alleged, by U.S. intelligence, facilitated by the Korean diplomatic personnel in their embassies around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we'll have to wait and see, the devil's in the details, exactly what the UN's agreed to do. But certainly this is progress, and certainly it's going to be worrying for the North Koreans if their money supply gets cut off.
Yeah. I guess we just can't send Dennis Rodman, huh?
Well, I thought the Secretary of State, John Kerry, was asked today what he thought of Dennis Rodman, and he said, well, as a diplomat, I think he's a great basketball player, which I thought was quite apposite.
Yeah. All right. I want to move on to another story that you had worked on. Red alert, China's defense spending increases while U.S. cuts back. Is this a surprise, or did we know this was happening?
Well, we anticipated, I think there was a broad expectation that defense spending would continue to rise. It, you know, it's risen double digits for more than a decade now every year. I mean, I think personally I was a little taken aback to see it still in double digits, given that the growth that's projected for the Chinese economy is only about 7%. So they're actually increasing it, not just in absolute terms, but in terms of, you know, relative to the size of their whole economy as well.
Mm-hmm. Any other countries doing the same thing, or is it just kind of them?
Well, you know, as I'm sure listeners are well aware, you know, the world's in a bit of a recession at the moment, and most countries are actually throttling back on their defense spending. You know, in the United States, we've just had about $500 billion of automatic across-the-board defense cuts, of course, you know, which are starting to be imposed now after the sequester fell on Friday. I think Japan has had a very modest increase this year, less than 1%, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that you've also got to remember that Japan's military is very small. It's a self-defense force. Until very recently, they were constitutionally barred, you know, by its own constitution from deploying its troops anywhere outside of its own country. So, you know, they're starting from quite a low baseline. I think that there is a lot of nervousness in the region, actually, you know, from the Japanese, from the South Koreans, from the Indians. China is really building this huge military which will enable it to project power, not perhaps globally like the United States can, but certainly regionally, certainly in these contested island chains in the East and South China Seas, which are the sort of key to unlock the mineral wealth underneath the oceans there.
I'm going to move on to my final topic for you today, and that is the insider's book, Obama is Dithering, Vindictive, and Controlling President. That's a headline that will get your attention, and this comes from a former State Department advisor?
Yes, an academic called Vali Nasser, who worked for a couple of years for Richard Holbrooke, the veteran diplomat who was the State Department's point man on Afghanistan and Pakistan. And it is really, it's quite a sort of devastating account. I mean, obviously, you've got to take all of these insider accounts with a little bit of context, a little pinch of salt. Obviously, he was a member of Holbrooke's team. He felt that Holbrooke was snubbed by the administration because he was seen as too close to Clinton and because the White House wanted to micromanage foreign policy. I mean, you know, I'm not sure. I've lived in this country about 13 years now, Andy, and I don't remember an administration where the White House didn't want to micromanage foreign policy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it is quite, you know, I mean, these books are from insiders. You know, we haven't seen the same kind of critical take that we saw on the Bush administration, really, right from the word go, from the Treasury Secretary, Paul O'Neill's autobiography, you know, The Price of Loyalty,
mm-hmm.
was within a few years. I believe it came out in the first term, Bush's first term. So you haven't seen this kind of insider account so far. I think as people start to shape up for the 2016 race, you'll see more Democrats perhaps staking out a position, you know, by distancing themselves or criticizing the administration. But Mr. Nasser, serious academic, serious thinker, you know, his account is extremely telling, I think, and it doesn't paint a very pretty picture of how the sausages get made in the Obama administration.
Yeah, the book, I believe, is titled The Dispensable Nation. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm going to have to check that out. All right, well, listen, Sean, thanks for your help on a potpourri of topics today, and we'll talk again.
Always my pleasure. You can put a potpourri in my pot anytime you want, Andy.
Thank you, Sean. Sean Waterman, Washington Times national security reporter. 5:45, 7:30 a.m. 102.9 FM WTNT.
My name is
5:58, 7:30 a.m. 102.9 FM WTNT. Andy Parks live from the Washington Times. A couple of things you'll want to check out at WashingtonTimes.com. Russia launched a massive nuclear drill. Pentagon alarmed. It's by Bill Gertz. It's at WashingtonTimes.com right now. There's another story up there that we talked about a little earlier on the program. You really need to read it. Email tells feds to make sequester painful as promised. That sounds a little dirty to me, but hey. All right, have a great night. Be safe. It appears the snow is on the way for later tonight into tomorrow. I'll be back here tomorrow at 3. If it don't get snowed out, okay? All right. Be safe.
Thanks for listening to the podcast edition of Andy Parks live from the Washington Times. Listen live weekdays 3 to 6 p.m. on 7:30 a.m. and 102.9 FM. WTNT, the truth.